Welcome to the U.S. Law Essentials Law and Language Podcast, the legal English podcast for non-native English speakers that helps you improve your English listening, improve your legal English vocabulary, and build your knowledge of American legal culture.
Welcome to U.S. Law Essentials Law and Language Podcast. I'm your host, Stephen Horowitz. Today's episode continues our series of interviews with multilingual lawyers. Today's guest is Jonathan Golub of the law firm of Wiggin and Dana LLP, where he is the chair of the Fund Formation and Investment Management Practice Group and also a partner in the corporate department. John got his law degree from UCLA Law School and graduated with a bachelor's degree in political science and Japanese from the University of Virginia. Earlier in his life, he taught English in Japan on the Japan Exchange Teaching Program, also known as the JET Program. And that's a program in which I participated as well, which is how I know John. Hi, John. Welcome, and thanks for being here today.
Hi, Stephen. It's a real pleasure to join you, and I'm happy to speak with you.
Now, John, I think, and tell me if I'm wrong, I think you are a father, a dad.
Is that right? That's correct. Yes.
Oh, good. Then I'm going to start off this interview with a dad joke.
I love dad jokes.
Okay. Ready?
Yes.
Why do fathers take an extra pair of socks when they go golfing?
I don't know the answer.
Well, we'll wait till the end of the interview, and then I'll give the answer. You okay? Can you handle that?
Okay. I'm on pins and needles.
Okay. So let's see. The first question I want to ask you, John, is have you ever lived in another country?
The answer is yes. But the only other country I've ever lived in is Japan. And I did that for 1 year on the JET program, and then another 4 years in Japan, working for an accounting firm and a law firm. So I lived in one country, but two different times.
Oh, wow. And when you lived in Japan on the JET program, what part of Japan were you living in?
I was living in Saitama Prefecture, and towards the north of that prefecture. So it would often take 1 to 2 hours by train to get into the city.
Oh, to get to Tokyo?
Yes.
I always thought of Saitama as kind of like the New Jersey or Connecticut of Japan.
Me too. It really, I always, for people who are not from Japan, I would always describe it as the New Jersey of Japan. And people would ask me why. And, you know, at the time, I had never lived in New Jersey. And so I had probably unfounded negative feelings about New Jersey. And so I just, because of popular culture, I guess, I thought New Jersey was just a land of, factories and, just didn't look very good, which I know now is not the case. New Jersey is a beautiful state in many ways. But Saitama at the time was a kind of an industrial prefecture. There were a lot of factories. Not the most beautiful prefecture that I'd ever visited in Japan, but it was very much a popular suburb to Tokyo. A lot of people would commute into Tokyo from there. And so it's an incredibly convenient place to live if you have a job or go to the university in Tokyo.
And did you like living in Tokyo as well?
I really did. At the time I was living there, I had just, during the JET program, after the JET program, I had graduated from UCLA Law School and took a job in Tokyo. And I was in my 20s at the time and just loved working there. It was such a dynamic city. And it just, there's always something new to discover. And it's obviously a very international city. So you can meet not just Japanese people, but people from all over the world doing everything, you know, jobs in finance, education, healthcare, you name it, they're doing it. And there's just some very interesting people living there.
Yeah. And you went from, you were in college in Virginia, and then you went to Japan, to this northern part of Saitama. Then you went to Los Angeles for law school at UCLA, and then back, and then off to Tokyo. So it must have been some culture shock or some cultural whiplash, perhaps.
Yes, absolutely. You know, the first, when I went to Japan for the JET program, that was when I really experienced culture shock. I'd never lived in a foreign country before, number one. And as you know, Stephen, Japan is such a different kind of country from the United States, culturally speaking and linguistically. And I had a lot to get used to in a short period of time. And so I was, you know, for the first couple of months there, I struggled a little bit, even though I had studied Japanese in college. And I thought that that was enough of an educational foundation to make a seamless transition. But in reality, it wasn't. You know, it's one thing, and as your listeners probably know, it's one thing to have an academic background in something. It's quite another to live it and breathe it on a daily basis. And for me, that I think was the source of my culture shock. You know, what I had learned in the classroom was one thing, but applying it to real life was another.
I always remember the first time I knew I was really getting the language was when I woke up and realized I had had a dream in Japanese, or I spoke Japanese. And it was a really short dream where I was sitting in a living room watching TV, and I was watching with a famous sumo wrestler named Takanohana, who at the time was a very famous and popular sumo wrestler. And he asked me if he could change the channel. And I said, sure. And that was it. It was barely anything said, but it was in Japanese. And that's, did you ever have a dream? Do you remember like having a first dream in another language?
I do remember that I had a dream in Japanese, but it was so long ago, I couldn't tell you what the content was. I do remember, though, it must have been some kind of a nightmare, because I do remember screaming in Japanese at some point during the dream, maybe out of frustration or anger. I don't know. But when I woke up from that, I was like, oh, wow, I guess this is a sign of that I've achieved some new level of fluency, because I did speak or yell in Japanese in my dream. So I took that as a really good sign. And at that point, you know, that was during my second stint in Japan, where I'd been working for an accounting firm, perhaps. And really, I was so immersed in the Japanese language, and not just conversational Japanese, but difficult legal and accounting Japanese, that it was just, I had to improve on so many levels, and doing it 24/7, that's really when those dreams started to come.
Oh, wow. And I guess since you can't really remember it, we'll have to skip the Freudian psychoanalysis of the dream.
That's probably a good idea.
Okay, so next question. Do you speak any other languages?
Unfortunately not. I would love to learn Spanish. Yeah. I would love to learn Chinese, because I think both languages have, are so useful these days. If you're, especially in the United States, I mean, Spanish is unofficially, I would say, the second language of the United States. And Chinese is just, I think, so important to learn, the same way that Japanese was in the 1980s.
Yeah,
I think the Chinese language is something that is important to know.
Okay, and now I want to ask you about your work. How, so you are, we might have to break this down first, okay? You are the chair of the Fund Formation and Investment Management Practice Group, and you're a partner in the corporate department. So first, what's the corporate department? How would you describe the corporate? Let's pretend that you have a daughter, and I think she's not quite old enough to understand any of this yet, but someday she will be. So how would you explain what the corporate department is when she's old enough? Well,
the corporate department really is at a law firm, and not just my law firm, but at most law firms, is sort of an umbrella or a catch-all for many other practice groups that engage in transactions and that represent companies, essentially. So what that means is, you know, you're representing clients in business transactions and structuring their deals and structuring the entities through which they conduct their deals. That is, in a nutshell, what a corporate department does in a law firm.
Okay. And then the chair of the fund formation, where is it? The chair of the Fund Formation and Investment Management Practice Group. So the chair means like the head, the chairperson, right?
That's right.
And the fund formation, that sounds sort of like fun formation, like you're forming fun things to do, but it's fund with a D. So what is fund formation?
So, you know, I could probably teach a course on this. And it's somewhat complicated for people who don't know this area, but a fund with a D at the end can be described as an entity, like a partnership, that invests other people's money in financial assets. So a fund is essentially a vehicle that allows, to put this in a little bit more of a complicated fashion, a fund is an entity or a vehicle that allows someone or a sponsor to pool the assets of third-party investors for the purpose of investing it in a strategy that is designed to make money for them. So that strategy can be many things. It could be a strategy that involves buying and selling equity securities, like shares of IBM or shares of some other publicly traded company. Or this investment strategy could be to buy and sell the shares of private companies. And those private companies could be doing anything. They could be developing a software product or developing a new medical therapy for cancer patients, or they could be, developing a new way to play games. So, you know, there are all kinds of strategies that you can, or people who manage money can deploy. And a fund is the way that they can collect that money from other people to invest. And so the other side of the coin is investment management.
Okay.
You're talking about. So when funds are operating or set up, they exist within a regulatory framework that's very complicated. In the United States, they're subject to various securities laws, and also not just securities laws, but court cases and regulatory agency interpretations. And you, in order to operate a fund properly, you have to abide by all these different kinds of law and regulatory agency rulings. And so that is what I do. I'm an expert in, well, I hate to call myself an expert in anything because I'm always learning. But I advise clients on how to navigate that complicated regulatory regime.
So a client might be somebody who wants to invest, or a client might be somebody who's organizing an investment vehicle or an investment fund could be from either side. Is that right?
That's exactly right.
So, John, how did you get into this field? I mean, based on your description, I have trouble picturing you as like a seven-year-old boy saying, this is what I want to do when I grow up, right? It's hard to predict something like this. So how did you end up working with fund formation and investment management?
That's a great question. You know, you cannot just hang out your shingle and start practicing in this area of the law. Like with many specialties in law, you have to learn it from other experienced practitioners. And what happened with me is when I transitioned back from Japan to the United States, I went on many interviews with many law firms to try to get my next job. And it just so happened through my networking contacts, I managed to land an interview with a law firm called Catton, Mutch & Rosenman in New York City. A friend of mine introduced me to a partner there who was in this field, who was in the fund formation and regulatory compliance field. And at the time, this was around 2005, the asset management industry was growing exponentially, and new funds were being formed all the time. And that law firm really was looking for new associates to train and service their ever-growing roster of clients. So when I got the interview through that mutual friend, I was asked, would you be interested in learning this area? I said, yes, because I knew it was a growing area of the law. And I, at the time, had done some, you know, basic corporate work, but I was looking to specialize. And so I was just being opportunistic at that time. And somebody said, well, here's an opportunity to specialize in something that not that many people know about. And so I was recruited into that law firm and learned from the ground up by spending many, many hours, long nights and weekends, billing my time to clients in this space and training and reading and just not leaving the office for much time at all. And that's really what you need to do.
Have you ever seen the TV show Suits?
I have not. I actually shy away from legal dramas on TV.
I finally watched it because it's about a young lawyer at this very prestigious law firm. And I have a feeling that the portrayal of what he does is not so realistic, and is more light and is more similar to your experience that you described at your law firm.
Yeah, this is why I don't watch legal dramas on TV, because they're just idealized fictional accounts of what real life is like in a law firm. If you want to know what real life is like in a law firm, trust me, it's nowhere near as glamorous as what you see on television. It's many hours of hard work and dedication and commitment to your profession. You have to meet very high standards at all times, because clients are paying, at least if you're in any kind of a large, or not even a large law firm, most law firms charge high rates for their work. And in exchange, clients expect you to meet a very high standard with your work product. And because clients expect that, the partners of the law firm expect that of their junior people. And when you're a junior person, you have internal clients and external clients, and you have to make them all happy. So what do? You spend many long hours perfecting your craft, being responsive to emails, you know, doing the research and trying to improve your knowledge all the time.
That reminds me of a story. One time when I was talking to an uncle, and I think I was thinking about law school, or maybe I had started. I was in my first year of law school, and he was a lawyer. I was asking him about his practice, and he was telling me about it. And I thought I'd get a little personal. And I said, how much do you charge? Like, what's your rate? And he said, if you have to ask, you can't afford me. And then I understood that. I thought that sort of put it in perspective and was an appropriate
answer. It is. I mean, look, I take a little bit of a different approach. I think you, when clients ask me that question, I'm upfront about it. And, but what are they paying for? They're paying for expertise. They're paying for competence. They're paying for a high level of service. And they're also paying what is market for the profession. And so right. Some people, if they can't afford it, they will look elsewhere. And if they can, hopefully they'll become my client.
Do you still use Japanese in your work?
These days I don't. And that's really because my clients are typically American clients who are investors. And so, there's no need to use a foreign language like Japanese. And by the way, as a lawyer, I'm always concerned that if I tried to use Japanese in my practice because, say, a client speaks the language, I'm afraid I'd commit malpractice by trying to advise them in their language. I know that if I advise them on something in English, that I'll get it right, or hopefully I'll get it right, and there's less risk of malpractice.
Yeah, that's one of one of the unique things about studying law and about studying English or studying law in English is that, or in any language, is that words have power. So having control of the language is such an important part and component and skill in terms of practicing law effectively, because you can change the entire nature of something or lose a client a lot of money by using a wrong word or a wrong punctuation.
That's exactly right. And I certainly would not consider myself bilingual by any stretch. And so if I were to try to communicate a legal concept in Japanese to a Japanese client, it's very likely or very possible that I would use a word that has the wrong connotation to the listener. So, because as you know, like with any language, Japanese is very nuanced, and there may be three or four words that mean the same thing in English, but convey a different connotation to the listener. And that's fine if you make a mistake in casual conversation, but when a lot of money is on the line and legal risk is at stake for the client, the last thing I would want to do is convey the wrong implied meaning to the client. So English is my native language. And so if I'm going to speak about something legal, I'll just keep it to English and be safe.
That sounds like a good strategy. Now, recently on this podcast, we talked to Brian Hersey, another lawyer who speaks Japanese. And you guys know each other, right?
That's right. Brian and I have known each other for a long time. We're friends and, our paths cross in the industry. We work in a very similar industry. He is on the bank side of things. He works in a custody bank. I'm in what's called private practice or a law firm side of things. But we... our paths cross because sometimes we have similar clients.
Now, what does an average day of work look like for you? Or is there an average day of work?
Yeah, it's a lot of emails, phone calls, and document production. So my work, we were speaking earlier about funds and fund formation. That is... really, funds are a creature of contract. And what I mean by that is they exist on paper. These are legal constructs that are documented in a contract. And the contract is typically a partnership agreement or an operating agreement for a limited liability company. Partnership agreements are for limited partnerships. Operating agreements are for limited liability companies. And so on a very typical day, I'll be drafting or reviewing these sorts of agreements. And again, I said, you know, a lot of emails and phone calls. Typically, I'm advising clients verbally on any number of legal issues relating to their funds or whatever their matter is, whatever their contract might say, and forming their entities. It's, again, like I said earlier, it's not glamorous work, but it's very meaningful for the client. And we're talking about potentially, if things go well, you know, transactions amounting to millions and millions of dollars. So, that's my typical day. And by the way, the days typically stretch into nights and weekends too. So, fortunately or unfortunately, it's just not a 9-to-5 job.
Are you familiar, as you're speaking about contracts, you reminded me, I just in the last couple of days learned about a podcast called Contract Teardown. Have you ever heard of that?
No. Tell me about it.
It's connected, and we're not getting sponsorship or anything or any payments from this company, but there's a company called lawinsider.com, and I think they aggregate, they have a whole database of contracts that they've gotten from SEC website, or from the SEC filings, I mean. And they make those contracts available, and they categorize and organize them in a way so that lawyers can subscribe to it and I think use it to help them, you know, create contracts for their own work. But they have a podcast in connection with it where they bring on a lawyer and they take a contract from the database, I guess, or maybe it was one that the lawyer actually worked on, and they tear it apart. They go through what's good about it and what's not good about it. And I think this podcast is just kind of fascinating, and I'm really interested.
I think that's the kind of podcast that only people like you and me would enjoy, but the general public may not really want to spend time breaking down contracts and when they're running on the treadmill in the gym or something. But that does sound quite interesting and something I could learn from.
Yeah. So anyway, I was just curious. I didn't know how widely it's known or listened to, but anyway.
And Stephen, before we go on, there's another aspect to my typical day that I didn't address earlier, which is marketing. So on top
of
yeah.
You're lawyers. That's something lawyers need to be thinking about all the time.
They always do, especially as you advance in your career, you, also have to look for new clients. And so a lot of my time, when I mentioned earlier, phone calls and meetings, a lot of that is for the purpose of finding new clients and explaining to new clients, if I'm speaking to one, explaining to them what I do and what they would be paying for my firm to do for them. So that is... we could have a whole other discussion and podcast about the business of law, but that is an increasingly important part of my day.
As you move forward in your legal career, or really in any career, you're either your revenue or your cost. So, you know, and as you get more senior, you kind of need to be revenue more if you want to have any sort of ongoing role or I guess in terms of job security or something like that. Yeah, so that does sound like a really good conversation to have. Oh, we're going to have to bring you back on to talk that one through.
Sure.
Let me ask you one last question. Do you have any advice that you like to give to other people or other lawyers or that somebody's given you perhaps that's been really valuable?
Oh, yes. And some of this comes from... another blogger that I sometimes read, but if you want to be a lawyer, you have to be committed and dedicated to the practice, whatever it is that your specialty is. And what does that mean? It means dedicating yourself to constantly learning. It means potentially long hours perfecting your craft. Means intellectual curiosity about whatever it is you're doing. And I actually think that's probably maybe a universal kind of advice, because whether you're a musician, whether you're an engineer or a lawyer, you have to have intellectual curiosity about whatever your specialty or your profession is. If you're not, as I sometimes tell people, if you're not geeking out about the subject matter that you're discussing, you're not looking for those blogs that break down contracts, or if you don't love really discussing the intricacies of your specialty, then maybe you're not in the right profession to begin with. And so, that is something I like to do. I like to geek out about, esoteric legal concepts that relate to what my clients do, because it's genuinely interesting to me. It may not be to anybody else, but it's interesting to me. And hopefully that's that kind of enthusiasm, I can bring it to the client as well.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, because if you get deep into the woods, into a particular topic or field, you know it well. Other people don't necessarily want to know about it, and that's part of what makes you valuable in any field or in any endeavor you pursue, even that's if right. It's tearing down contracts. So,
correct.
Okay, so... before we go, I have to give you the answer to the dad joke from earlier, which is, why do fathers take an extra pair of socks when they go golfing?
Yeah, I'd love to know the answer.
In case they get a hole in one.
Oh, I should have known the answer to that. I feel like. Yeah, it's so obvious. It was staring me in the face.
Take away your dad license for missing that.
Well, I'll tell you how I'll keep my dad license. I'm gonna tell my wife that joke, and it's a perfect dad joke. And if she groans, I get to keep my license.
The groan is what really lets us keep our licenses as dads. That's a well-known scientific fact. Anyway, John, thank you so much for joining us here today. I really appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you. It was a pleasure speaking with you, and I'd love to come back if you have more questions.
Okay, and thanks everyone for listening to U.S. Law Essentials Law and Language Podcast, and stay essential.